Hey, everybody, this is the semi-scripted Ben Friedman with my introduction to the best of Gwyn Sound. Now, I wanted to offer some basic explanation about my interview with Tom Gwyn that you're about to hear. It actually took place before I completed my full assembly of the best of Gwyn Sound, and that kind of sounds it here and there. But with that in mind, let me mention, Tommy was at the studios of KKIT in Taos, New Mexico, about 30 miles from Angel Fire, where he lives. So I wanted to thank General Manager Dan Cordova, who is now enjoying the Instant Radio station on all 7 Alpine stations out there. Little commercial for the Instant Radio station. One thing you will hear about is the search for the package Tommy and Tom Merriman did in New York City. With none other than Doc Severinsen and Quincy Jones, okay? Now, I'm kind of talking about CRC Series 25. If you look down into the Best of Gwyn Sound guide sheet, you'll see the notations on the Quincy Jones package. There also seems to be a little confusion on actually who sang the famous high chick jingles, you know, that female scat over the high brass. Well, that was either Ida Sue, Jackie Dixon, or Judy Parma. Now, I know Jackie and Judy are probably listening to this, so give it an ear and let me know who did what, okay? Appreciate it. Now, this interview does give some thanks and acknowledgement to a fair number of really important players in the Dallas jingle business, but I also have to mention some names that were not mentioned that are critical here. My good buddies also. Brian Beck, Dan Alexander, Jim Clancy, Abby Holmes. These are the names that are so important in this jingle business, the key names to get that great Dallas vocal sound, and all the other singers that Tommy used in earlier eras. Wonderful sound. You'll hear it progress in the Best of Gwyn Sound. I also wanted to thank a great woman, Jean Gwyn, Tommy's lovely wife, really, who is one of the basic important secrets behind the success of Gwyn Sound. She's a fine symphony caliber violin player also, but Jean backed up Tommy in the office. I call her the backbone of the Gwyn Sound operation. Now, of course, first credit goes to Tommy's partner here, Tom Merriman, and I call it partners because they were partners in CRC, partners in Gwyn Sound. Tommy played drums at TM, and of course, Tommy played drums at PAMS also, and my good buddy Bill Meeks over there. Also, very important that I mention some of the other fine folks who assisted me in the assembly of the construction of Gwyn Sound. So I'm going to give you some names here. Very important people. Thank you very much. Steve Mitchell, Norman Barrington, Ken R., Don Worsham, Tracy Carmen, Eddie J. Rothschild, Steve Farrington, Bob Mitchell, Trevor Stern, Ted Tateman. How about the guys in Holland? Okay, Jelle Boonstrom and Benno Rosen. And am I going to get your name right here? I want to say Marty, okay? Martin Schultzjes. Did I get that right? I'm going to go over some other Dutch names later. A little harder even. Now, here's some other names that are critical in my general experience level with Gwyn Sound. You know, the old names and some of the new names, like Steve Stevens, Howard Lapidus, Ken Justice, John Wolford, Mike Gitlin, even Gordon McClendon. How about Tom and Judy Parma and Ron Harris, Jim DeMunk? Wow, Jim DeMunk, an amazing name as part of the Gwyn Sound operation. Bill Shannon, Hugh Henry, Alan Hardy, Sean Martin. These are some real major jingle collectors and buddies of mine. Fred Horton, Joe Myers. How about Peter Cans? Whoa. Now, I also want to thank probably way over a dozen Dutch jingle collectors. If I could pronounce your names, I would do it, okay? Even my old apprentice from Holland, Gert de Lanke, Gert, they called him. Now, I called him Jerry, okay? How can you say Gert de Lanke? I can't say that, but I guess I did. Anyway, also wanted to thank Don Worsham. I know I mentioned his name, but Don was so critical in getting me the CRC stuff for this presentation. Don, I appreciate it deeply. So now, I'm going to start out with the long-awaited Tommy Gwyn interview from February 2003. We're going to slam through a lot of great stuff here, but let's start out with the Tommy Gwyn interview. Okay, hi, Ben Friedman here with jingle legend Tom Gwyn. Tommy, are you out there?
I'm here.
Well, I'm delighted that you made a trek. Tell us about your trek that you made this morning to get to this studio.
No problem. It took about 25 minutes, and there was no snow. It was dry and sunshine. Beautiful day.
Now, you're out in Angel Fire, New Mexico. How did you get from Dallas to Angel Fire?
Well, it wasn't easy. No, what we did, we retired, okay, and we started looking for a place to, we were going to buy a new home. In fact, we bought two. We bought one about 20 years ago in 73, And it was a huge home, so we could have all our three of our daughters come up, you know, visit and
right.
and so on. Big 10-room house, and it was up there behind the country club in Angel Fire. We stayed there 10 years, and we just finished, not just finished, but 10 years ago we built a new home, which wasn't as big because the kids don't come see us anymore. It's that simple. you know how that goes.
Oh, sure.
And so we're very relaxed. We take it easy, no pressure. We just do as we please every day. Every day the sun comes up. Jean does all the music for the First Baptist Church there in Angel Fire.
Right.
She plays all the organ. She rehearses a choir, writes some things. She doesn't play violin anymore because arthritis has gotten to her just like it has to me. My hands are absolutely destroyed.
So now tell me, how did that start back in Dallas to affect your career? About what year was that, and how did it start affecting you?
As far as playing?
Yeah.
Oh, when I was 4 years old, I started playing the drums. It's that simple. And my dad bought me a bass drum and a snare drum and a dumb-looking cymbal, and I think it cost him $25 total.
And you had quite a career doing that.
Yeah.
But about what time in your career did the arthritis start to affect you so much that you really couldn't play correctly?
Well, I could play correctly, and I still can. It just hurts a lot more now.
Yeah.
Fingers are swollen. You know how arthritis affects you.
Sure.
It just destroys your hands.
And apparently all that drumming that you did probably contributed
right.
to the early advance of it.
Right. Well, see, I started playing when I was 4 and a half, as I say, and I started with the Dallas Symphony when I was just a kid, I guess I was 18, Principal Timpani. I was there 10 years. The jingle business opened up in Dallas, big time. There were three or four companies there at the very beginning. And Tom Merriman knew about me because I'd done a lot of his sessions, playing and producing and so on. So he hired me right off for the staff. Me and Hoyt Hughes and Tom Merriman really started that company up.
Well, we're going to talk about that. Let me just backtrack just a little bit to your career between when you were 4 years old
yeah.
and when you hit the Dallas Symphony.
Yeah.
What drumming did you do? Did you take drum lessons?
Took some drum lessons from a Mr. Dave Durden there in Amarillo, Texas. That was our home at that time.
Right. And how long were you in Amarillo? Right through high school?
Right through high school, right. I graduated when I was 17 because I had to go to summer school in order to get out and try to get some college before the draft hit me. And I was, as I say, I was 17 then, so I went to Fort Worth, started in college at TCU.
Right.
And I spent a year and a half there. They finally drafted me just before the war was over. I was 1A, took my physical and everything, of course, and was ready to ship out, had 30 days, and they declared the draft holiday because the war was over, and I didn't have to go.
So what did you do at that point then?
Well, what I did at that point, I was still working with the symphony. I was 18, right, when I started there, and I was there 10 years. I stayed with the symphony. The recording business opened up about that same time, and I was just busy as heck. I was doing everything.
How did you get into the symphony? That's not an easy task.
No, sir, it is not.
It's very difficult. What kind of credentials did you present to them, or did you just audition, or how did that work?
Yeah, I auditioned, and, of course, I was studying at that time with the principal timpanist who was there at Dallas at that particular time.
Okay.
He was with the Air Force Band. I'm not sure it was Air Force. It was the 8th Army Band in Europe with Patton. He was with Patton's band.
Right.
Okay, when he was taken out of the service, he came back here, auditioned for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, which opened in 1945. He got the job of principal timpanist, went into the orchestra, heard about me. We got together. I started studying from him, and he decided to go back into the Air Force and get his career. Pick up his career and finish up there so he can have his, you know, full benefits and so on. And I auditioned for Dorati, who was director at the end of the Dallas Symphony. Got the audition as principal timpanist, and I started there full-time in 1948.
So how did that lead to jingles?
Well, the jingle business was getting big all this time. It was growing and growing and growing because we had some great writers and great musicians there in Dallas.
Now, how did you first hear about the jingle business in Dallas?
Well, they called me. Tom Merriman started calling me for sessions back in while I was still in college.
And he was with CRC at that time?
No,
it
was an individual. Everybody was an individual contractor.
Okay, so he just went to the radio stations themselves, developed the sales as kind of a one-man approach, or was he working with people then?
Yeah, it was a one-man approach, all right.
Right.
He would not only call the commercial advertisers there in Dallas and go out and make presentations of stuff he had already done, you know, stuff he had already recorded.
Right.
And as I say, at that time, Dallas was just mushrooming, just beginning to get started good in that business. And when I started with CRC and Tom Merriman, this was in 1948. I resigned from the symphony, and the very next day I went to work for CRC and Hoyt Hughes. Hoyt Hughes was vice president and general manager then.
Now, how did you relate into CRC? Were you a partner in there at that time?
No, not at that time. No, I was just doing I was doing all our sessions.
Right.
In other words, I had an agreement with them that I would do all the recording, playing, and also I was doing all the mixing at that time. In other words, when you do the recording session, you lay a track down.
Right.
Okay. And then what you do, of course, is add the singers and the announcers and whatever else, you know, sound effects and so on that you need. You need multi-track, of course. And we had an 8-track at that particular time.
You did?
Yes. And then and eventually, of course, very soon, we went into a 16 and 32.
Now, what brand? Do you remember what brand machine they were?
Oh,
the
8-track?
Could they have been Ampex?
Probably were, because everybody was using Ampex. There was nothing else that compared to it
at
that particular time. And we're talking about a 1948, you know, 49, somewhere in there.
Because that would have been early day for an 8-track.
Oh,
there's
yes.
no question about that.
Yeah. I remember there was one studio there. It was called Pop Sellers Recording Studio, and everybody had to do their stuff there because he's the only guy that had enough microphones and enough room, you know, to put a fairly large band together.
You said CRC was with Hoyt Hughes also?
Well, Hoyt Hughes came in with Tom Merriman as soon as Tom opened the doors and started making calls on clients, you know, recording auditions, piano and voice, to get the idea across as far as the lyrics, the time sequences, as far as 60 seconds, 30 seconds, 20 seconds. You know that routine.
Well, tell me just a little bit about Hoyt.
Hoyt was from, as I remember, south. He may have been from Corpus Christi or Houston. I don't remember now. He came in and met Tom, and they got together and started a commercial recording corporation.
And then how did Pam's fit into all this?
Pam started, I'm trying to think of the year. I went to work for Tom in 48, okay, the very day after I left the symphony. And by the way, at that time, this, you know, is old hat to me, but may be of interest to you and your listeners. At that time, seasons of symphonies were limited to something like 25, 30 weeks a year, okay? Mm-hmm. And you signed a contract at that particular time for so many weeks. And, of course, a lot of the times it included tours. You know, you'd go out and do 3 or 4 weeks of concerts all over the place, all over Texas, south, everywhere, and to help pick up the tab for the symphony people that were sponsoring the bill, you know, paying the musicians. And we were at that time at State Fair Auditorium in Dallas, which was a huge auditorium. It seated over 5,000 people. Had a huge balcony, beautiful auditorium. It was built in 1936, which was the Texas Centennial, 100 years. It was built that year and opened just for that occasion. And as I say, it held over 5,000 people, and we packed the place. And Antal Doradi from Hungary was hired by the owners of the symphony in Dallas. He was hired from his post, which was in Hungary at the time. He was a conductor of operas and symphony orchestras over there.
I was just going to say, when PAMS was operating at that same time in the late 40s, or was it in the early 50s that you remember them
PAMS
coming
PAMS didn't start until, let's see, I started the CRC in 48. It must have opened just about the same time. And Bill Meeks was the owner of PAMS, of course, and he started that organization. I did some sessions for him before I started to work with TM.
Tell me a little bit about working with Bill.
Well, it was all right. Bill didn't do much of his writing. He did some. Sometimes he'd do lyrics, melody lines, things like that. But he mainly was a salesman. He would go out on the road and sell his ID packages, his commercials, and so on by himself. He'd just get in the car and go out and beat the bushes for clients.
Well, you know, I got to know Bill very well also in the later years.
Yeah.
And he was a marvelous personality.
Sure. He was a go-getter, man.
Yeah. He had the kind of likable personality that could make a sale.
Well, he knew exactly why you did what you did at the time. And a good guy. And he wanted me to go to work for him. In fact, he kept hounding me all those years that I was at CRC, which was almost 10 years I was there.
But you did go over there to play drums.
Yeah, sometimes I did before I signed a contract with CRC to do them specific their stuff. And that's all. In other words, I didn't want to do, I couldn't do anything else for anybody else at that particular time when I did sign.
But you did mention when you were later on with Gwyn Sound, you did play drums
over
there.
Yes.
At 4141 Office Parkway.
Right, right.
Well, I'm guessing that would have been, you started Gwyn Sound in 65, and you went through and all the way until, I think it was about 86, wasn't it?
Yes.
Somewhere in there. Because I know I think I took over Gwyn Sound for you about 86.
Yeah.
And then you probably had a lot of great experiences over at PAMS and TM. Can you just tell us about any kind of funny things you can remember or what it was like to be over at those places?
Well, Bill was a good guy. He left me alone because he knew I knew what I was doing. And he called me because I could read, you know, most of the drummers. And I don't care where it's here in New York or Oshkosh or wherever. Most drummers at that particular time couldn't read their name. Well, you know, you'd put a part in front of them, they'd turn it upside down because they didn't know which was right side up.
Yeah.
That's the problem. So
I know what you're saying.
So anyway, I could read it, and the first time, and a lot of times, we would take the first cut because you have a lot of spontaneity. You have on the very first cut, when you're sight reading and so on, you're on edge because you want to make sure it's right. And a lot of times we would take the first cut because there's a lot of sparkle to that first cut. You know, everybody's really trying hard. They're reading the thing, and they're trying to make it go. So there were a lot of learning process involved in this first few years.
And so they had a pretty good time over at PAMS and at TM in those sessions.
Oh, yes.
And I imagine at Gwyn Sound it was the same kind of thing.
Yeah, same. Well, she used the same guys.
So now, how did you transition out of CRC and into Gwyn Sound?
Oh, no, it was no problem. You're doing the same things. In other words, we had at CRC, we finally got, we started with a 4-track. We finally got an 8-track and then 16, of course, 32, the whole bit, like everybody else. When you could afford the things, you know, you bought them because you had to have them for overdubs. In other words, you were adding singers, you're adding announcers, you're adding sound effects, you know, all the time. So
let me ask you this.
Yeah.
How did you get from CRC to Gwyn Sound? There was a breakup there, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened?
I'm trying to think now of the years.
This probably would have been about 1965.
Okay, I left CRC in 65 or 66. Yeah, and of course I was doing freelance then with PAMS and, of course, Tom Merriman.
But, I mean, Tom Merriman went on to start TM Productions, and you went on to start Gwyn Sound. CRC did continue for a while longer, and then they went under. Do you know what happened to the guy to CRC, the company itself?
Oh, yeah. Well, now, what had happened, he had made special deals with the ownership of KVIL there in Dallas, okay? He came in that station as vice president and general manager, okay? He didn't own the station. Troy Post owned the radio station.
Right.
And from what he gleaned, Troy Post I'm talking about, from local people, this guy was a hustler as far as business goes.
Mm-hmm.
So he hired John Coyle to come in as vice president and general manager, take over the station, start hiring people, and try to bring the station up because it was a fledgling, you know. It was nothing at that particular time.
Right. So you basically said, Tom Merriman, I'm going to start my own company called Gwyn Sound.
Right.
And Tom Merriman said to you, I'm going to start my own company called TM. Is that basically what happened?
That's a bit.
And you agreed that you were going to continue to work together where that sort of overlapped, meaning I know you mentioned that Tom Merriman wrote quite a few of the Gwyn Sound jingle packages.
And he wrote nearly all of them.
And you played drums over there at TM, I imagine, when he wanted you to come over there. And it was one big happy family, kind of like the way it was when I was in Dallas all those years. You just kind of compete, but you work together at the same time.
Yeah, well, see, you had a few key people there in Dallas. I mean, Dallas was not a big city at that particular time, even though it had the symphony. You got a lot of fiddle players, you know, a lot of string players in the symphony. In other words, you're talking about 90 to 100 people to make up the composition of a symphony orchestra, you know.
Right.
And you know how big that is. Of course, Fort Worth was trying to get started with a symphony of their own. It took them a lot longer because they just didn't have the backing, the money, and the member the management capability. But Dallas was roaring immediately, and they had tours going all the time. We would do 5 and 6 week tours, which were that was all included in your contract. You signed at that particular time. You would sign all the way from 18 weeks. Well, 20 weeks was minimum. You signed 20 weeks to 24 to 26, depending on how many weeks they had on the road.
So when you really got going with Gwyn Sound, you sort of had to discontinue anything you were doing with the symphony, probably.
No, I kept doing the symphony too until I signed a contract with Tom Merriman that I would be exclusive. You know, with him. In other words, I would do just his stuff.
Oh, you mean as far as him writing Gwyn Sound material, or you playing at TM, or both?
Both.
Okay, right. Gotcha. Well, right. That makes sense because you wanted to continue
right.
the affiliation.
Right.
So
now, all this time, too, I hate to interrupt you, but I got to put these in when I think about them.
Yeah.
Because my brain's kind of scattered at this age. I was
mine's scattered, and I'm only 53.
Right. Well, anyway, all this time, as soon as I came off the road the last time in 55 with the Dorsey Band, okay, and Tom lived another year and a half or 2 years before he died. But when I came off the road in 55, I had done all the television shows, which you saw, the Jackie Gleason show.
Mm-hmm.
And I did all of those. I did 55, okay, from 55 through 66. I taught 11 years at North Texas State University. I was principal a percussion teacher there.
You know, there's something on the internet about that,
yeah.
about you doing that.
Yeah, could be. I'm sure it was. I was there 11 years.
Yeah.
Leon Breeden was there at North Texas. He had gone from TCU, and he was my band director when I was at TCU there in Fort Worth. I had gone from there to SMU. I was teaching part-time at SMU all the hours that I had available, and also TCU. And I had a lot of private students. I taught all day Saturday. When I was at CRC, the stage was mine. You know, all the equipment was mine. So I just booked private students in there, and I would teach from 8 o'clock Saturday morning to 5 o'clock in the evening all day Saturday, and, of course, do all their sessions too. And then I was free, of course, to do extra gigs that came in, you know, whatever came in, shows, whatever. I could do all those that I wanted to when I had time. So I was busy. Very, very busy.
Well, now, all of this is leading up to some of the real hot questions that people want to know out there.
All right.
And that would be the people that you worked with at Gwynsound. Now,
yeah.
we've mentioned that Tom Merriman wrote a lot of the packages, and you and I know he's a brilliant guy. Did you not mention that Yule Box had written some of your packages also?
He wrote some of them.
Because what we're concerned about, I think everybody wants the famous Series 2 and Series 5, where you hear that brassy with the high girl,
yeah,
the high chick singing up there. That sounds so much like the Pam's Series 27 and 29.
Sure. Everybody was doing the same thing.
Do you think those were done by Yule Box at Pam's?
Oh, yes. He was on staff there.
And so, but you did mention that you didn't use the high girl, the Glennie Rutherford, who was the Indian gal from Pam, such a wonderful person. And who were you saying sent you thought might have sang up there? Would that be Jackie Dixon, possibly?
Jackie did some of them. Yes, mm-hmm. She didn't do them all. But she was our lead singer there at CRC.
Well, Jackie's a wonderful person. She's also known as Mrs. Tom Merriman.
Yeah, right.
These days.
Right.
And she is just a great person. Tell me about working with Jackie.
Well, it was very easy. She was a good gal, and she tried to cooperate in every way. I was, of course, a little fussy, as was Tom Merriman, you know, about how he wanted, what he wanted. And she tried very hard to please us all. She was a very good gal. She was there from, I'm trying to think, I started in 55. There were three of us there, Tom Merriman, Hoyt Hughes, and myself. We really started that company as far as CRC goes.
Right.
And Jackie came in. We finally hired a group on staff so they couldn't work anywhere else. In fact, I brought in Billy Ainsworth, too, from L.A. He was working at Tail of the Cock Lounge then with, I'm trying to think, I think the guy's famous. I just can't think of his name now. He had a little quintet there. And Billy played clarinet and alto and tenor. He played all the horns, okay, the reeds, and a fantastic musician.
And who's the other lady singers? Was it Liba Weeks?
All right, we had Liba Weeks, right, and Ida Sue, of course, Ida Sue McCune.
Right.
Then we had Billy Ainsworth and Dick Cole and Charlie Thompson. That was the original five.
Dick Cole, who was the former head of the Dallas Musicians Union.
He was a singer, and he also played trombone, of course, very fine trombone player, best trombone player in town.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And then as you moved on to the from the CRC to the Gwynsound era, you updated the singers, obviously. At some point, fairly early, you were bringing in Brian Beck and Dan Alexander and Jim Clancy.
Yeah, right.
And I know you mentioned you had Clark Womack a couple of times,
yeah.
and even Chris Kershaw, you said, in the later days, sang on that Series 18, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, he did some of them. Most of the singers, most of the series, was Ida Sue McCune, Jackie Dixon, Liba Weeks, Dick Cole, Billy Ainsworth, and seemed like we used six sometimes. I can't remember who the other one was.
Mm-hmm.
But singers changed quite a bit because there was so much demand for them.
Well, sure. And then you brought in, of course, you knew her as, I guess, Abby Anderson.
Yes.
She's under the name Abby Holmes now, and she's just such a wonderful person.
Yeah. I guess she is still there working.
Yes, I've done projects with her, numerous projects, and again, she's just a delight to work with, as so many of the people in Dallas are. That was one of the things I noticed that was just wonderful was the camaraderie that I had with the people. And with guys like Tom Merriman and Bill Meeks and others, Toby Arnold, and just some of the real people that have been down there forever and just know how to do this business.
Well, I'll tell you something that is very interesting, and a lot of your listeners might not understand it, but in New York, everything was kind of uppity, and there were certain people that did all the work just about there, just like Dallas. But at the same time, in Dallas, we appreciated what we were doing and getting to do, because this would never have happened if it hadn't been for Tom Merriman and Bill Meeks and so on. Just those two guys were instrumental in getting this thing off the ground.
Well, I'm going to put you on that list because everybody thinks of you as one of the big three.
Well, bless your heart.
And you certainly deserve it, Tom. And I know everybody is fascinated by what we're coming up with here today.
Yeah.
So now let's just, if we could, just talk a little bit about the additional musicians that you worked with there.
Right. Okay. Of course, Dick Cole, the best trombone player in town.
Right.
He was in the group. We had Billy Ainsworth, of course. We brought him in. He was at the, I just remember now, it was called the Tail of the Cock Restaurant there in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working with, and I'll think of his name in a minute, too, a very famous player at that particular time. It was a little, I think it was a quintet at that time. Billy played clarinet and accordion, you know, just about everything he could play. Tom and I went to the West Coast to do a session. It had to be somewhere in 86, 87, somewhere in there. And Billy and I met, of course, because we were good friends on the Dorsey Band. In fact, Billy got me on the Dorsey Band.
Wow.
First year I joined the band was 1951. Okay, and I was on the band 51, 54, 55, and during the TV shows, the Gleason shows and all of that. So I knew what Billy could do. He could write, he could arrange, he had perfect pitch. I mean, you couldn't find a better musician anywhere.
And you used some fantastic horn players.
Yeah, right. He played everything. He played clarinet. Clarinet was his favorite instrument, but he played alto sax, tenor sax, baritone sax, any saxophone you could name, you know, and he did a lot of writing for us, too. Very talented guy.
And I imagine when you brought in string players, you brought in that main crew from the Dallas Symphony.
From the Dallas Symphony, right. And what we would do a lot of time, and everybody was doing it, we would stack the strings. In other words, instead of having to bring in 18 or 20 fiddle players,
mm-hmm.
you know, you would use four, the top four in the symphony, like the first violin players and so on, bring them in, viola and cello and so on, and then stack that and stack it again and stack it again until you had the Longines Symphonette there.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I'm sure that initially the musicians were probably a little bit fracked out by that. I know that certainly in a place like New York and L.A. originally, I'm sure in the 50s and 60s, they got a little backed off by that.
Oh,
but
sure.
That's
of
progress. Tell me about unions and working with unions.
Well, we didn't have too much trouble. See, the reason was, of course, at that particular time, the scale was $27 an hour. And you know how much money that was in the late 1940s and the early 50s? And it was a fortune. And so they were lucky and happy to get called for an hour session. You know, it was 25 or 30 bucks. And they would make 10 or 15 normally.
Now, you mentioned that you went to New York City to do that package with Quincy Jones, the mysterious Series 25.
Yes.
Can you just tell me about that? What can you remember about that?
Well, of course, Doc Severinsen and I were on the Dorsey Band together.
Right.
Doc was the lead trumpet player. We had five trumpets on that band. It was Doc Severinsen, Ray Wetzel, Charlie Shavers, Bobby Nichols, and George Chibb. And all those guys, you know, are top of the line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't mean locally. I mean nationally.
Of course.
Because Doc had done everything in New York. And, of course, we got five trumpets. We had four trombones on the Dorsey Band. It was one hell of a band in 1951. And, of course, there was recording money along with that. There were television shows. So, you know, I hit the crest of that thing, you know. And I guess you can call it luck if you want to, but I happened to be there and I could do it.
Well, what happened with Quincy Jones? Do you remember how that got set up?
Well, Quincy had just produced an album, okay? And I've forgotten the name of it now because Cavill used to play it all the time.
Yeah.
It was a great big band thing. And as I say, it's pretty much the same trumpet player as we used when we went to New York, and he wrote the stuff for us. I mean, all the fantastic players you've ever heard in your life were on that session, including Doc, you know, everybody else.
Well, we know we're going to pay a lot of pennies to anybody that can come up with that package because we don't have it in this initial presentation, but hopefully we'll dig it up and we'll get it on these discs.
I'm sure we can find one somewhere.
Yeah, that's exciting.
I may even have it somewhere in the archives. I don't know.
Well, tell, just briefly, getting back to the Dallas scene about working with Trella Hart and Peyton Park.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned that they were at one point tied into PAMS exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
You did eventually get them in the mid-60s. Do you remember how that evolved, or how I'm sure you were very excited about getting them in a session because they're some good talents.
Yeah. Of course, as things, as you say, evolved, which they did, everybody figured out, of course, the scale by that time, by the 60s, was somewhere in the neighborhood of $30, $40 an hour. And now it's, I understand, when I left there 20 years ago, it was right at $100 an hour. And, of course, what happened was it was so high, no producer could afford them anymore. You know, so that's why all of a sudden the musicians got docked. They didn't get hired anymore because nobody could afford them. At $100 an hour, 20 people, you know, for a 4 or 5 hour session, you can't do it.
Well, with Trella and Peyton,
yeah,
you must have evidently known that they were very popular at PAMS and that they were using them on a lot of sessions.
Oh, sure.
And I presume that you probably had a customer that came to you and said, I want to get these people, and that's how you finally got them over to do that Series 9. And I noticed that Trella was doing a lot of the commercial jingles that we have. They're both a delight to work with.
Well, you know, the way it works, it's hard for people to understand that are not in the business, and especially at that time. When you hear that the scale, are they going to pay you $50 an hour to come in and do a vocal? You know, let's say you're going to do a commercial or you're going to do an ID or whatever. $50 is a hell of a lot of money. You know, even now, $50 an hour is not bad wages. So at that time, when people would call to do sessions, they knew they were going to make some money. And also, they were going to have fun doing it because it was always a good band. It was always a good commercial, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. They wanted to do it, and they wanted to be on the crest of everything that was happening. And that's what we were doing. Man, we were doing it all.
Tell me about some of the sales guys that you can remember that were down there, the people that generated the business.
Okay.
Do you remember? I mean, we know we're going to give a tribute to Jim DeMunk here, but he's a little bit further on in your history.
Yeah.
At CRC and with other jingles that you worked on, I mean, who were the people that were lining up these orders and that were, other than Bill Meeks, and was getting things together?
Yeah, salesman.
Did you know Walter Winicky at the
time?
Oh,
yes. Walter worked for us.
Well, he worked at CRC?
Yes.
Okay, because we know he worked at Future Sonic also.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about Walter a little bit, because I think he was a key figure back then.
He was. He and Bill Meeks and trying to think of some of the other guys there.
Otis Conner wasn't involved at that point.
Otis
Conner
was he did some work for us too. Yeah.
He did. So hey Otis, you're kind of old now.
Yeah. Well, what happened? And this is hard for most people to understand. You would work for a recording company, and either you would get crossways with the ownership, or you would get crossways with a writer or whatever, and all you do is just go across the street to another place and go to work.
And that's what Walter apparently did.
Yeah.
Well, we all did that.
Yeah, everybody did it. That's right. You find a better deal, you get a better salary, you like the working conditions, you like the people better. You know,
I mean, a lot of people ask, why Dallas? How did it happen in Dallas more so? Why didn't it all happen in New York or L.A.? We know there was union differences and differences in approach.
Yeah.
But I think that the whole Dallas situation was sort of like a unique experience, a unique combination of events that led to what happened there in a huge production center. And honestly, I think it still comes down to Bill Meeks and Tom Merriman and yourself.
Yeah, it does.
Because this is really, I mean, if you take the three of you out of the picture, and none of this would have happened.
That's right. You got nothing.
And it led to so many other things, and so many good companies now still using the same formula out of Dallas. I mean, there are a couple of other jingle centers that are doing it. Some guys out in Seattle are doing a nice job.
Yeah.
But I think the whole Dallas experience is something that everybody is so curious about. And tell me about commercial jingles out of Dallas.
Oh, yeah, we did tons of them. I mean, we did this whole CRC service library there.
Sure, I'm familiar with
made
that.
Made up of, you know, 20 or 30 CDs, double face, you know. And we produced that as the Moneymaker. That's what it was called, the CRC Moneymaker Library.
Oh, I still have the demo.
Yeah, and we've got on that, we've got all kinds of non-custom commercials. All they do is drop in the message that the announcer wants to add to it. They've got a whole 60-second or 30-second or 20-second spot on the record, you know. All they got to do is take it out to the client, sell it to them. They can sell the whole library. At that time, it was going for $1,800 for the complete library, all right? And there was 30-something CDs in that library. And we sold the heck out of the thing, especially to small markets, because they didn't have a prayer of how you produce anything. You know, they didn't know. All they had was an announcer, possibly.
And at Gwyn Sound, you had a demo that you sent out for a long time of syndicated jingles.
Right.
That
yes.
probably mainly sent them to agencies and radio station sales departments.
That's right. We'd send them in care of the advertising director there at the radio station.
Right.
And I had the same thing. I had over 50 non-custom, okay, commercial 60-second spots, okay, that I sold all over the country. And I would sell them for $300, $350 each and just adding the vocal group to it. And they had their own announcer. You know, they had their own message on it.
It just happens to be that we're going to play some of those
yeah.
right now on the CD.
There you go. Let's see. I left the symphony. I started in 48 and left in 57. Started with CRC and Hoyt Hughes and Tom Merriman. And I was there 57, 67, 77. I retired finally in 83. Okay. And chucked it all. And we built a new home up here. In fact, we built two. And, you know, we're just relaxing. We try every day. We try to take it easy. That's what we do.
So I guess it must have been 1983 is when I took over the Gwyn Sound and the DeMunk deal. And I'd just like to talk about Jim a little bit because
great
Jim
guy.
DeMunk and Tom Gwyn did an amazing job. I mean, I know you sold a lot of things without Jim being involved naturally, but Jim seems to be something, your whole relationship was a little different than any other jingle company has.
Yeah.
And I'm, as I said, quite familiar with it because I took it over in 1983, but he had a radio program.
Yeah.
And at the time you did it, it was called Temple Time.
Right. He had Temple Time, Light and Life Hour, the Quiet Hour. He had a bunch of the religious programs.
That's right. And he was called Words of Hope when I did it with him. And Jim would develop radio station clients that would stimulate a custom package.
Right.
And then he would put it out on his own separate demo.
Sure.
And right now on this presentation, I'm going to break off and we'll go ahead and play a little chunk right here of what Jim did with Gwyn Sound. Here it is.
Hi, this is Jim DeMunk speaking. DeMunk Similac & Company is celebrating just about 20 years of service to the broadcast industry. We're proud of that, and we're also proud of the following audition series for your station. If you would like to hear additional series or series in another format, please feel free to call me collect at 414-564-2001 or drop me a note at 914 Center Avenue, Hoosburg, Wisconsin, 53070. 1981 looks like a good year for us, and we hope we can help make it a great year for you.
Celebrating DeMunk Similac's anniversary year. Now's the time to cheer and lend an ear.
Okay.
Jim and I got along great because we were straight as an arrow, you know, between each other. And he had, I'll tell you what he did. He handled all of the placement of the religious programs on the radio stations throughout the country, and it was also Hawaii, Canada, Mexico, South America. He handled it all over the place, and I didn't have to worry about anything because I knew he was handling everything, and he was straight.
Oh, yeah. How great can it be when Jim would call you up and say, hi, Ben, hi, Tom, I've got an order for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to mail it in to you,
right.
Get it done, and you got a deal, you know, and then he sends his checks, like, right on time. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's like Bank of America.
Yeah, exactly. So, Tom, just tell me a little bit about when you got into your first studio at Gwyn Sound. Where was it, and what was the equipment like?
Okay, the first studio that I got into after I had left CRC was at, I'm trying to think of the guy's name that owned it. He had a hillbilly band there in Dallas, and he worked at the Levy Club. Okay, you may have heard the place. It was a Dixieland band. And Tommy Loy was playing trumpet on it, and Peyton Park was playing clarinet. Bass player, I can't remember his name now, or the piano player. But anyway, it was a five-piece band. And they started there at the Levy Club, and that place just exploded, man. Made money out the ears. And the guy that built Summit Studio eventually, the brand new studio there that I moved into, and I was there 10 years with office space and everything, and I used their studios and their equipment.
So then when did you get into your first regular studio?
Okay, this was Ed Burnett that owned Summit Studio at that time.
Okay.
And I was there 10 years. I signed a 10-year lease.
And what street address was that on, or what
okay,
part of town?
Okay, so Oh, boy, it's been 40 years ago.
But that wasn't in where you were in the bank building.
No. That was the after place. The bank building and before I built my own studio.
Right.
There at my home. Can't remember the address now, but it was right off North Central Expressway toward town. I can't think of the street or the number. Sorry.
That's okay. So as we're probably going to have some photos of these, I'm hoping that we're going to get together with this presentation.
Okay.
Then you're in the bank building.
Yeah. I was in Richardson, Texas, and I was there 5 or 6 years before I moved to Summit, where Ed Burnett, that was his name. Ed Burnett had a Dixieland band. He played banjo, and they sang and had the regular gamut of a little Dixieland band.
Right.
And Peyton Park, you know that name, played clarinet and tenor. And sang, did all of his funny little vocals and all of his comedy and so on. And that place just exploded. It made a fortune. I mean, they were probably there 10 or 12 years before he had decided to sell the thing.
And then when did you move into your home studio?
I was there 7 years total with my new studio.
Right.
So, and I left in 86, so it had to be 78, 79, somewhere in there when I built it.
Let me ask you about some of the other names and jingles to just see what your reaction is. What did you know about Pepper Tanner in Memphis? And you know they had an operation in Dallas. You probably played for them, too, I'll bet.
Oh, yes. I did things for them. Larry Muhoberac ran that office in Dallas, Muhoberac. He eventually went to the West Coast.
And this was at the Regal Row studio?
As Regal Row.
Yeah, and that's really Tom Merriman moved into that studio after they closed up and moved back to Memphis.
Right.
And then Marvin Shaw, that's probably how you met him.
Yes, yes.
He went on to Memphis.
Yes.
And, well, you probably knew him from previous to that.
Well, yeah, I used him some in my vocal group, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep, gotcha.
Yeah.
What about Johnny Mann? What did you know about Johnny Mann?
I didn't know a thing about him, except I had great respect for him, what he did and how he recorded and so on. I never had the pleasure of meeting the man.
How about Chuck Bloor?
Chuck, no, not him either.
As they worked together out in Los Angeles and did a lot of interesting things,
right.
But there was always the Dallas mystique.
That's right.
There was always, why is it that there's just a slightly different edge, slightly different sound that comes out of Dallas that maybe we like a little bit better, maybe sounds a little bit more like what a jingle is. Pepper Tanner, of course, ruined their whole reputation by doing a whole bunch of sameness.
Tell you what it was. For one thing, we were friendly with everybody. Everybody that came in, I don't care if you came in from Podunk, Texas, you know, with some money to do a commercial, or he wanted some IDs or whatever. He was treated first class, always. And that's, you cannot say that with Pepper Tanner. Okay, they would fluff this guy off, give him a secretary to take him around town and buy him lunch and whatever, and that was it. And I really shouldn't say it, but that's the way it was. They were too big, and they just didn't want to fool with you if you didn't have a lot of big money.
Yep. Well, certainly the people that are listening to this have a good knowledge on that. There's no question about it. And that's why Gwyn Sound has always been so interesting, because when you really look into it, like we're going to on these CDs, you can see that it was just every bit as amazing as Pam's as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Certainly didn't have quite the numbers, but when you look overall at what you did, and especially the blend of the singers, the amazing quality of the recording, how you got the brass. I mean, I think personally you have the best brass and the biggest timpani and drum sounds. You just are totally the greatest drummer. But I mean, it's just that fatness of sound that you've gotten on this stuff. I mean, I don't think anybody can come as close.
Well, I tell you, we worked on it. We didn't just bring a client in and set him down and take his money and give him something to put in his hand that was 60 seconds long and to tell him, you know, we'll call you, don't call us. We appreciated the clients that we did get in. And I entertained those guys a lot of times. A lot of times I'd have to go to the airport and pick them up, which was no big deal. Take them to lunch, you know, make them happy, come in, and they can sit down there in the studio right beside me. I was in engineering, mixing, and so on. And they felt they were like they were part of it, you know?
Well, that's the whole Dallas experience. That's what they always called it when I did the same thing, the Dallas experience.
Yeah.
And there's nothing else like it. There's no question about that.
Well, we were poor. You know, we needed the business, and we appreciated it. It's that simple.
Let's just take a second here and analyze the station ID jingle, the history of it, because you've seen it all.
Yeah.
You've seen it start out with the basic function being really one of two things. One was a sort of a long basic station theme where there'd be a piece of music in the front, then it would go into a vocal, then a little bit more music, then maybe a little more vocal, and then an end sing, and then maybe a musical piece at the end.
Yeah,
okay?
A tag.
And there would, the other thing would be the disc jockey theme,
mm-hmm.
where it would clearly come in and say, a verse about the disc jockey, then a break, then another verse, then a piece of music, then a closing.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of evolved in the late 1950s to the point where it was a piece of music in the front, then the vocal, then an end piece of music, and a quick out, you know, a half of a signature, not the whole thing.
Yeah, maybe. Usually it was 60 seconds. You know, it was 60 seconds long. Sometimes it'd be longer. An announcer, a jock there at the station, would pay for his own thing,
mm-hmm.
pay for getting the thing done for himself. And, of course, we'd do it just like he wanted because it's his money. You know,
well, there was a lot of pressure, as you know, on getting down to the music and cutting the station music, but still putting it in the ear, getting that subliminal effect, but doing it in a shorter period of time. And then, of course, you know, I'm sure you're well aware of what happened in about 1966 with KHJ Radio and the Drake RKO General chain, where all of a sudden they're running just the acapellas.
Yeah.
And it was just 93 KHJ. And it was just more music, fast, medium, and slow, KHJ. And I know that Gwyn Sound, and that's when I started my first business, Acapellas Unlimited, in the late 60s. Everything was just as short as you can make it.
Right.
And but just they want like 8 different versions of it. But the good thing was is that every station wanted one of these things.
Yeah.
So instead of a station buying maybe once every 3 years, all of a sudden in that one period of years in the late 60s, 67, 68, 69, every station wanted to have those acapellas. And there was a huge rush to get those done. And then, of course, KHJ decided, you know what, we're going to put a little bit of music with it. We're going to have ba-da-dum-bum-ba-da-dum-dum-bum-bum. Then we're up to your Series 15, which was like 69 in that era.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, then we're evolving to a little bit more music in the jingle and a little bit more lyric, the best hits of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, a little more music than the end piece. So we actually have seen it go from really cool, long ones, down to just horribly short.
Yeah.
And then it evolved back to having some music with it.
Right.
And today, I think it's a little bit better when you really analyze it than it would have been. I just hated doing all those acapellas.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
was just, it just, you know, where was the music?
Yeah.
What could you develop?
Yeah. We did so many acapellas at that particular time. I guess it covered several years and I wasn't aware of it because you just get dull, you know, all the time because they're just like you say, there's no music. You know, it's all voice. And you got tired of it. We got tired of doing it. There was no color to the thing. You know, it was just, what can you do with five voices? You know, it's limited. So you needed the brass and you needed the saxes. You need good orchestration. You need good recording technique and quality. And it all of a sudden it just disappeared. You know, so we were glad to see it come back.
So I'm going to go ahead now, and I'm going to play a test of Series 2, okay? I'll just let this one jingle run by and see if you can hear it within reason here.
Okay.
Here
it comes.
New music, more fun.
It's the swingin' one.
WROL 1490.
Yeah.
You could hear that.
Great cut.
Well, Series 1 and Series 2, as you mentioned, became Series 2. How did that happen?
Well, first of all, when I started, I didn't have any money. You know, I didn't have enough money to start up. So what I did was take a 20-cut package, and I did the first 10 cuts, and that was Series 1. Okay? Then when I got the other 10 cuts, that was Series 2, and it was evolved. You know, they put them together, and that was 20 cuts.
And originally, my understanding is the demo was for WROL, then it became WACK in Newark, New York.
Right.
Do you remember, did you say it was because of a change of singers?
No, it wasn't. I can't remember who was on it, but I'm sure it was Ida Sue, McCune, Libba Weeks, Bill Ainsworth, Dick Cole, maybe Charlie Thompson, but I can't swear to that, as he was being edged out a little bit, and I can't remember who the others are.
And you think that that was a Yule Box package?
Oh, no, no, no.
That was Tom Merriman?
Tom Merriman wrote it all.
Because that was so similar to what the Pams. What do you think Yule might have done for Gwyn Sound?
He only did, as I remember, one package, and I can't remember what it was. And I think it was WSIX in Nashville, and it was a good music package.
Okay, well, that's actually what we're going to be getting to next is a package. Let me just run the jingle, and then I'll just play it for you here.
All right, something else here before you cut me off.
Okay.
All those years that I was running Jim DeMunk, okay, and I was doing all his stuff, of course, Jim would call me every year or so to do a new series for WSIX
right.
because he had a continuing contract, you know, years and years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to play some here.
Yeah. And when the renewal would come up, of course, there would be extra money in front, you know, to do instrumentals and so on to get a new package going.
Sure.
So that's what I did every time a new renewal would come up for SIX or ACK or whoever, you know, whoever it was. Then, of course, we had extra money to spend for musicians, you know, and writing and production. So that's how it happened, man. I just took what was given to me and, you know, wailed away with it.
Good. Okay, Series 3 now.
All right.
Great music.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite a production.
Yeah, great series.
And this kind of falls into the mode that I was speaking of, is that there was a lot of singing and music back and forth until the finality.
Yeah, what year was that?
Well, I'm guessing that this was probably 1966.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking. It could have even been 65 as your very first year of Series 3 would have been really the second package that you launched into.
Yeah, it could be 65 and 66.
We don't seem to know what Series 4 is. We do have a very old package. I can't play it for you here now, Tom, but I'm going to run it on this disc. And we're going to run that now, and then we'll call it Series 4.
Okay.
All right. Now I'm going to play you Series 5, and we're going to talk about that. Here it comes.
Okay.
You're where it is, the giant sound of KSL Radio, Channel 95.
Yeah.
Tell me now, how did KSEL come to be? Is just one Jim DeMunk came up with?
Let's see. Wasn't that Lubbock?
Yeah.
I can't remember. I don't know. Beats me. It's been too many years. I'm too old.
Well, Series 5, I'm sure you can remember that
oh, yeah.
was your biggest package.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got your old sales register here, and I can tell you, you cranked out a whole bunch of them.
Well, I'll tell you what that was. If that was Series 5, we did it at the old Summit Sound Studios. There, I've forgotten, Rio Grande, I think, was
Daniels.
The name of the street. Daniel Street. Yeah, Gene just came in. Daniel Street there in Dallas. And, man, I was so broke, you wouldn't believe it. I didn't have a dime, and we were bringing in these musicians, you know, at thousands of dollars an hour. And it had to be good, or else.
Well, you must have been pleased that you had so many of them.
Yeah.
And how the word got out on the street about Gwyn Sound real fast with Series 5, because a lot of major top 40 stations were running that package.
Yeah.
Let's take a listen to Series number 6 here. I'll play you a cut. Here it comes. Here, Tom.
Country music starts at dawn, and the fun never sets when your dial is on. WZIP Cincinnati.
Yeah.
Country stations were real country stations back then.
Yeah.
It wasn't this using the top 40 packages.
Well, what that was, basically, of course, we used country players, same group, but country players. But actually, all Tom did was disguise it from big band stuff down to country and western. You know, same licks, same things, different instruments.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the same writing went into it. We did the same licks, if you'll get them side by side and play them, you know, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Right.
You'll understand.
Yeah, no, you just plugged in the country-sounding instruments and rhythmically speaking.
Yeah, put a bunch of straw hats on all
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, it's very close. There's no question about that. Okay, well, that was a great package and a good market, too, Cincinnati, to have
yeah,
that. That was
right.
Really good. That again, everybody was impressed when you came out with that. And the little Gwyn Sound boxes, which we were so pleased to get that you were so good at sending to me and so many other guys in the beginning days.
Yeah.
Before I started to sell for you, I was an avid collector, of course.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're going to hear Series 7, Tom. Here
okay.
we go.
Yeah.
Well, that was a big band almost.
Yeah, and if you'll notice, a lot of that writing, of course, it's different instruments, and like in country and western, you've got guitars and fiddles and things like that. But the writing, the instrumental pops in the middle, in other words, the little bridge music that you hear, of course, is all Tom Merriman. All he did was change instruments, you know, change instruments from guitars and banjo and things like that to strings and brass and so on.
Well, he did a brilliant job.
Sure.
Okay. Well, we're going to listen to Series 7. Now we're going to go on to Series 8 here, okay? Let me run it for you. Here it comes.
I don't remember that one.
Barry Farber, Barry Farber, Barry Farber, Barry Farber.
Cabinet members, scientists, generals, and spies. They wouldn't talk for love nor money.
But they'll tell.
Barry Farber, Barry Farber, Barry Farber.
On WKAT.
The talk.
Of Miami.
Yeah.
Now I know you remember that. Series 8, that was an amazing production because talk radio really had never had any jingles that I had ever heard. And yikes, that was really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's hear Series 9, which is one of my favorites. I actually had a jingle out of this series you cut for me myself.
It's happening.
In the stratosphere, ionosphere, the troposphere, and right down here. WLOF.
How about that package? You remember that?
Oh, you betcha.
Yeah, that was a big one also.
Yeah.
And that was the package that you had Trella and Peyton on.
Yeah.
Series 10 was for K-Box in Dallas. I'll play you this one here.
We're number one for swinging country fun. KBOX 1480.
Series 10, that would meant a lot to me because K-Box was one of my favorite top 40 stations. And when they went country in January of 67, it was a big event.
Yeah.
And I bet you were privileged to know that they were going to change format before anybody else did.
Yeah, we had to.
And that must have created a big stir locally in Dallas.
I made a lot of waves.
Well, you know, that's how it goes in radio. That's what keeps the jingle company going, is the changing of formats, changing of program directors, changing of ownerships.
Yeah.
That's a big element in there to make sure that all these people get fired and hate the radio station.
Right.
Now, Series 11 was a breakthrough package in my mind.
WYCL.
A lot of people know that demo as Series 11X.
What was it named?
It was the time of Pam Series 36, and it was a time just before they got into all of the Drake stuff and all of the acapellas.
Well, there was no name 12. On that series, huh?
Series 11 was really a musical package, but it just had a short piece of music and then almost an acapella ending. And you used a lot of those, the guys in like the high-low fashion with the high guys, which was really, kind of taken off of Pam's Series 31 with a real high guys approach. Then all of a sudden, Bill Drake hit in and we got Series 12. Let me run you that, what this sounds like.
W-O-L-F.
Acapellas and guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know that. Series 12 was the steel slide into the acapellas, and it was just real quick. And that's when this Johnny Mann stuff was starting to hit, and there was a lot of pressure put on you to get those kind of packages. But on the other hand, Jim DeMunk's calling you up and saying, hey, you know what? WSIX is ready again. Mm. Here's Series 13.
WSIX, an air of good listening.
Acapella.
But did you notice that guys blend again?
Yeah.
Kind of like four freshman high lows.
Man, I'd forgotten about that package.
Yeah, that was something that you were able to cut through because that sound did cut through. And that was just a Dallas miracle that you could get vocals to sound that good.
Yeah, you know what happened on that thing? They didn't want any more instrumental outs and instrumental ins.
That's right.
They wanted the acapella, the call letters, bang. That's it.
Yep, that was the era.
Yeah.
Series 14, going to play you one now for Series 14.
The mighty 1150.
Well, listen to that vocal group.
That was the full vocal group.
Yeah.
And again, they wanted something just kind of fast with a little bit of music on it. Series 15 is one of the probably the most famous one. Here it is here.
W-O-L-F.
Yeah. Johnny Mansingers.
Yeah, Series 15 was the famous one, what we call the Rum Pum Pum package that had those two music, the fast and the slow.
Right.
That had to bring in the call letters. But it did start out all of a sudden with percussion, and that was important to start to get a little bit more music into the jingle.
Yeah.
And Series 16 was a country package. I'll play you that one here. That was sort of a kickin' country.
Yeah.
Series 16. Country starting to pick up in the pace a little bit.
Okay, it was called Cookin' Country.
That's right.
Cookin'.
Now, Series 17...
Center of
Well, that vocal sound was great.
Man. Tremendous vocals.
Yeah.
And again, they're all of a sudden noting play a little bit more music and pick up the pace. But something else was happening in Top 40 radio. There was a revolution against that standard vocal sound, the all-American jingle singers. So they wanted the solid rock singers. And I'm sure you remember that. We're all the same group, but just singing it all together, vibrato-ish and so forth. Here it is here.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that pack.
It makes you shake in your boots.
Yeah. How many series did I do anyway?
I hated it. I hated everything to do with vibrato. I loved the regular jingle sound, but it was kind of like a counterculture jingle. At least they were keeping it. They wanted it to sound like rock singers,
yeah,
supposedly.
Right.
But I never cared for it too much, but it was an era.
Yeah.
And I think that's when you said that Chris Kershaw came into the session.
Well, it could have.
I think so, yeah. Now, Series 19, I'll play a little piece of Series 19 here.
Okay.
W-I-L-S. Series 19 is just a combination of Drake and brassy things.
Yeah.
But starting to get more musical.
Yeah.
They were getting more musical. Now, Series 20, WSIX, is getting really hot here. Check this out.
Weekend music. WSIX, Nashville.
Yeah.
So you notice WSIX has come up in tempo all the way with the music styles.
Yeah.
And now they're a hot AC.
Yeah.
Series 21, I watch country is heating up a little bit more here. You know what that was? That was apparently made in 1976. I'm guessing that was the bicentennial year.
Yeah.
And I know you did a combination package that you took for 76 also, some of the tracks that we have.
Yeah.
Now, Series 22, this is big time.
W-T-R-Y.
Series 22 was big time. That was where all of a sudden the best of Tom Gwynn could come out, where you were given the timpanis and the serious fat brass.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, give me a front. Give me 4 seconds of that or 5 seconds of that, and then into a big-sounding seven-voice group.
Yeah.
That's when jingles started to get good again.
Well, I tell you, of course, we were stacking all the time, but then we had seven voices and we stacked them. So you got 14 parts on there, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one, Series 23.
W-I-S-L Music.
Yeah.
Same thing, Series 23, big and bold. We don't have Series 24. We talked about Series 25. Let me run you Series 26 here, okay? Here it comes.
68. W-I-N-R.
What was the name of that?
It was just for W-I-N-R. But again, it was kind of like that disco bubbly sound, which had to come into it all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You hear that little bubbly synth front? That was from sort of like the disco era. Series 27 was for W-O-N-D. You put everything into this package. I know you. I'll play it for you here.
The best for you.
You remember that, I'm sure, because that was something that I remember you telling me at the time you were making it, and you were recording it on a 24-track machine, I believe, at that point. Did
yeah.
you not? Or was it 16-track?
Well, 16 or 32, one or the other.
Yeah, it was the 2-inch format, because
yeah.
I know I have the masters, the big 2-inch tapes.
Okay, well, it's 32.
That was a big production, Series 27.
You?
Well, I'm guessing that probably was about 1982. It would just been just before you finished up.
We had just moved in Summit. Yeah, we moved in there in 80, I think.
Well, that was quite a production.
Yeah.
And then there's a thing. You told me you hadn't heard of this, but I've just got to play you this one thing because everybody is so curious about this.
You're a pussy cat, you're where it's at. The one that's in on every play.
The aliens are
big L.
You noticed in the beginning there, we heard a few Gwynn sound jingles being clipped and
yeah,
cut up.
Yeah.
That was taken off of The Who Sells Out, you know, the musical group The Who, and this was out probably about 1968. They just went into some UK British stations that were chopping up Gwynn sound, and as you know, it was happening with regularity over there.
Yeah.
And they put that on their album to simulate sort of a commercialized setting.
No kidding.
You told me you did not know about that.
No, I didn't.
And that all those years they were running and they've been selling that with Gwynn copyrighted Gwynn sound material on it. So what are we going to do? We're going to sue them?
Good grief. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's something that's curious, and it's a big compliment to you.
So they were cutting them up and making their own cuts.
Well, what they did was, it was the idea of the Who Sells Out was supposed to be this commercialized ripoff concept, and they wanted to play some of the radio jingles to show commercialism at its greatest, yeah. And that's why they cut those up. But I think it's funny, and I think it's a great compliment to Gwen Sound that they did that. I want to play you one other cut here before we wrap it up here, Tom.
Where's this my money?
This is the famous Rosencrantz jingle that I sold to my college buddy, and I think everybody agrees this was the wildest jingle ever recorded.
Come on, Rosencrantz, let's go! You're with Rosencrantz, go, go!
Stuart Allen is his name, Mudge Gregory is his game, the fanatical pundit on the stereo!
What series was that out of?
Well, that was out of Series 5.
I thought so.
He was one of my college roommates. And he loved the idea of me with Ken Justice selling the Gwen Sound jingles for you.
Yeah.
And he said, it's nothing to do with radio. I have to have a jingle for myself. I want to put it on my 8-track machine in my car and loop it, put my convertible top down, and drive around the campus at Butler and blast this thing. Because, you know, I was a Butler student at that time. And that's what we did. We got into his 1967 Thunderbird convertible, turned that up, and when classes were changing, he would drive up and down the streets and play that nutty jingle. Krekety is Yiddish for kind of a crazy guy.
Yeah.
And I called him the fanatical puppet. So that's how we made that jingle. And everybody loved it. And that's probably the wildest and craziest station ID ever cut.
I wonder if they ever played that at TCU.
I have no idea, but it gets around on my collector's tapes. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, I wanted to thank you so much for doing this interview. It's been very enlightening.
Well, I enjoyed it.
And I'm looking forward to selling a bunch of these and getting the word out on the street about how great a job you did with Gwen Sound.
Yeah, bless your heart.
Well, thank you, Tom.
All right, thank
you. Tell Gene I said hi, okay?
I'll do it.
All righty then.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Jazz the coolest.
Beat the swinginest.
DJ's the smoothest.
Program's the zinginest.
News the latest from everywhere. Still the greatest on the air. WRDW, Southern folks for miles around, tune to Augusta for their favorite song. Your dial at night for Channel 71 listening as KWEL brings you music. Music in the when you're driving along with your radio on at KWEL.
folks in Augusta go to church. Once a week Augusta stops to pray. WRDW urges you to thank your God for all his blessings as Augusta goes to church. It's a holiday here in Atlanta. It's a holiday. Set your dial on WGSD and just relax on this holiday. Take a holiday, take a breather just for fun. Like a day of fun on a holiday. You can have a better holiday if you'll only make WGST your holiday companion on your holiday. Holiday!
Night and afternoon, as KWEL brings you the top 40 survey each and every day. This is C, C-H, C-H-U, C-H-U-M, C-H-U-M, 1050 on your dial. Toronto. WGST, first in listeners. Number one on your listening list. WGST, first in listening. Every day, in every way, Atlanta listens first to WGST.
Wake up, wake up. Time to wish you a pleasant good morning. Wake up, wake up. Don't rush off in a hurry. Let's take a moment to say that K-E-E-L wishes you a very pleasant good morning today. Hey, sleepyhead, rub your eyes, get out of bed.
It's a brand new day and time to say good morning.
Say, sleepyhead, the day's begun, the night is dead, and it's great to say
from all of us good morning.
You can't stay there in that bed. You've got to get up and get dressed. Enjoy your day as K-E-E-L brings you the very best.
So good morning from K-E-E-L. C-H-U-M Toronto, C-H-U-M Toronto. Want good music day and night? Stay right here, your dial is right. Everyone in Toronto likes C-H-U-M. C-H-U-M Toronto. Comes Phil Land with an armload of records to spin. Coming up, Phil Land.
move it on over and let him in. He plays the tops, the latest hits, you'll hear the pops, your favorites. So listen to Phil and Phil and Ball, one and all on the Phil Ladd Show. Now's the time for music on the Morning Man Show. You can lose those blues quick. Get set, get ready to go. With the very top tunes from across the land. Your favorite singers and your favorite bands. Now's the time for music on the Morning Man Show. Wonderful music on the Harvey Dom Show.